All right, beginning here on the last line of Nunchet Amud Bet, we're continuing what the Gemara already had started yesterday, which is speaking about the issue of Malbin Pnei Chaveiro Barabim, embarrassing someone in public. And here you have the statement, Amar Rabba Bar Chanan Rabbi Yochanan, Noach Lo La'adam, She'obo Al Safek Eshet Ish, Ve'al Yalbin Pnei Chaveiro Barabim. It's better for a person to be engaged or to be involved in the possibility of Eshet Ish, of adultery, rather than to embarrass his friend in public. The reason for that is because of the situation that is by David HaMelech. Minale, midedorish Rava. How do you know that this is true? From the drasha of Rava, the dorish Rava. Rava has a drasha. Maidichtiv. What is meant by the pasuk? Ubitzali samchu vene esafu. And then it's like dot, 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 dot. Because they're skipping a part of the pasuk here. And karu velo domu. So here, tzalu is probably from the shorish of tzolea, to limp, but here it means, ubitzali, when I stumble, samchu, they celebrated. Vene esafu, and they gathered, and then the pasuk continues again to say who gathered, or who are these people that are gathering against him? Karu'u velo damu. They ripped me open, and they were not silenced, based on the drasha of Rava. It's going to be doresh this in a allegorical manner. Amar David ifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shalom, Galui v'yadua lefanecha. Shema yu mikarim b'sari, if they ripped open my skin, lo yadi dami shotet la'aretz. My blood would not flow to the ground, would not drip out to the ground. Meaning that I have a tremendous amount of tzidkut, he's saying, or that I am righteous in many ways, and therefore even if they ripped off my skin, I wouldn't bleed because of my righteousness. V'lo'ot. Ela afilu b'shasha uskim b'nigaim v'ohalot. When they are discussing matters that are not relevant to the topic at hand, we'll see, they're discussing Nigayim Va'olot, Omrim li David, Habal Eshrish, Mitato Bameh. Person who engages in adultery, what is their punishment? Vani Omer Lehem, and I respond to them, Mitato Bechenek. He is punishable by one of the Arba Mitot, Beitin, one of the four Mitot that is carried out or meted out by a Beitin, which is Chenek, Ve'yesh lo Chelek le'olam haba. But such a person has a right to olam haba. Aval, amalbin et pnei chevero berabim, someone who embarrasses their friend in public, ain lo chelek de olam haba. Does not have a chelek de olam haba. So a number of things to address here. First of all, what's the issue of nigaim ve'ohalot? Tosafot suggests that nigaim ve'ohalot was just that they were off topic completely. Had nothing to do with the topic, and then they interjected, bal ish mitato b'meh. They were poking, they were instigating David by saying such a thing. Obviously, they were referencing to the incident with Bathsheba. That's the way that the Baal Tosafot view it. If you look in the Maharsha, he speaks about the fact that Nigaim are associated with Lashon Hara, and therefore Nigaim and the association with Lashon Hara is the connection here, which is that they were speaking about David HaMelech. Again, it was true. Not anything untrue about it, but they were speaking Lashon Hara and causing a lot of pain and difficulty for David HaMelech. And the Maharsha points out that Negaim and Olot always come together, in that they're a package. Whenever the Shas speaks about them, they come in a package or they're learned together, and they are found in the Mishnayot, also juxtaposed to each other in Mishnayot. So therefore, that's why they are together. Number one. Number two is, over here it says that a person who engages with an Eshet Ish, mitato bameh, he gets a punishment, a death penalty that's meted out by Beit Din, but yesh lo chelek l'olam haba. The problem is that at the end of yesterday's daf, we said that there are shlosha shiordim ve'in olim. There are three people who go down into Geinom and don't come out. One of them was haba al Eshet Ish, was someone who engaged in adultery. So you have to reconcile between what is being said here versus what is being said there. We mentioned the Baalei HaTosafot yesterday who distinguish between what it means, Yordim ve'einan malin. He gave two suggestions over there. One was that they go down to Geinom, but they're there for the 12 months. Einam olim means ein olim yad. They don't come out immediately, but they remain there for the full 12 months. You give another possibility that means that they go down to Geinom. They're removed after the time period that they need to be there. But then Einon Olin means that they don't go up to Gan Eden or Olam Haba, but they also don't stay in Gehinom. They sit in this in-between state. So that's a possibility of how you can reconcile between them. Others suggested the difference is whether the person is given the death penalty. that if he's given the death penalty by Beit Din, then that individual has attained kapara, and therefore they go to Olam Haba, versus the case before where they did not attain that kapara. The other distinction that is made is also noted by the Balei Tosafot at the way end yesterday, which is that be'asa tshuva. If a person does tshuva, then maybe they are zocheh l'olam haba, versus the case where they don't do tshuva, and therefore they are not zocheh l'olam haba. But then he suggests that someone who's malbin et pnei chaveru berabim ain lo chelek l'olam haba. That person has no chelek l'olam haba. Now that was also mentioned in the list of items. There was eshadish, and then a malbin pnei chaveru berabim. So why by one of them do we say you do attain olam haba? By the other one, you do not attain olam haba. So we mentioned the Rabbeinu Yonah and the Shari Tshuva yesterday, which is that the Rabbeinu Yonah suggests that it's a problem of tshuva. Problem of tshuva. A person who's Baal Eshadish, someone who engages with an Eshadish, he knows he has to do tshuva. He knows what he's done wrong. The Avera is apparent and obvious, and he knows he has to do tshuva, so that's how he ends up rectifying the problem. Hamabin Pnei Chaveru Berabim, many times is not aware of the fact that they're doing it. And even if they are aware of the fact that they're doing it, they don't understand the severity of what they are doing. And therefore, they never come around to doing tshuva. And that's what causes the difference between them, which is that an Eshadish will end up Be'olam Haba, but a Malbin Pnei Chaveru Berabim will not end up Be'olam Haba. The Rabbeinu Yonah also makes a suggestion there in the Shari Tshuva that Malbin Pnei Chaveru is much greater, and that's what coming up in the Gemara we're going to see in a second, that it compares it to throwing oneself into the fire. It's because the Malbin Pnei Chaveru Berabim has two aspects to it. Has one aspect, which is we'll call the equivalent of Ritzicha, the killing of the individual, which is what the Memra that started this off that we spoke about yesterday, which is that when the blood leaves the face of the individual, the red and then the whiteness that comes to the person, that's the equivalent of killing them. So that's one thing. But then there's a second stage to that, which is the mental anguish that the person suffers afterwards from the embarrassment. That's a secondary effect of a Malbin Pnei Chaveru Berabim. And therefore, they have the two aspects here. Not only like Eshadish, which is you have an Aveira, or you have a discrete event that takes place, but also on top of that, you have a problem of the mental anguish that you leave behind. And that mental anguish is what causes the person to lose their olam haba or make it worse than killing or giving up one's life, we'll see in a second, because of that additional mental anguish that you cause the individual. That's how the Rabbeinu Yonah mentions it. The other thing to note is that there might be a distinction here when we mentioned before that it says that Eshadish is Yored Ve'inu Leh, and then we said Yesh Lo Chelek Olam Haba. There are others that distinguish between whether there's a child born of that extramarital affair, because that child is a mamzer. So then that's what we call muvat sheinu yochol litkon. It's a mistake that cannot be rectified if there's a child born of that illicit relationship. And then that is a possibility that will result in the individual not ending up in olam haba. Whereas if it's a discrete event that doesn't have results afterwards, then maybe there a person can do tshuva and attain olam haba. Others also suggest whether how it affects other people, meaning that it caused the dissolution of another marriage. So therefore, if you cause the other person pain, difficulty, or a breakdown in the marriage, so that would also distinguish between what we saw before by Eshadish versus what we're seeing over here, and also might create the distinction between why the Eshadish gets Olam Haba, whereas the Malbin Pnei Chaveru does not get Olam Haba. The point being that David HaMelech says, yes, that I did sin, and yes, that I did do something wrong. But there is a big difference between me and you, which is the fact that I, who made a mistake, will be able to do tshuva and rectify the mistake that I did and end up in Olam Haba. But you, who are intentionally embarrassing me about this issue and trying to undermine my standing, you individuals will not end up in Olam Haba. And what you're doing is much worse than what I ever did. Now, the last thing to discuss here is it says, Noach lo adam sheyavos safek eshadish. That it's better that a person engage in safek eshadish rather than embarrass his friend in public. What is safek eshadish that is being discussed over here? So Rashi brings, based on the Gemara in Shabbat, that kol omer David chata, enu elo toeh. Anybody who says that David sinned is mistaken. Now, it's difficult to say that because the Gemara in other places, including here, makes it obvious that David did sin, especially given the drusha that we just saw, which makes it obvious that he's saying, yes, that even though I sinned, I'm going to Olam Haba, but you are not going to Olam Haba. But Rashi, based on that Gemara, or playing on that Gemara, says, what does it mean that it's a Safek Eshedish? So Rashi quotes there that the Gemara, that Kolo Yotzei Le Milchamet Beit David, any of the soldiers that went out to war from Beit David, used to give a get to their wife, Al Tnai. And the get Al Tnai was that if I don't return from the war, then you are divorced. The reason generally being is to prevent the woman from having to go through Yibum. Tosafot already says, well, if that's the case, it only be applicable to a woman who does not have children or an individual who has brothers. But if either of those two are lacking, then they wouldn't have given a get. So Tosafot then opens up the possibility that they gave the get not just because of Yibum issues, but because of Aguna issues. That if the person didn't return from the Milchama, then the get would go into effect and the woman wouldn't be stuck with the unknown information about what happened to her husband in this situation. So Rashi says that's the reason. She's a Safek Eshedish because it depends on whether her husband comes back in the end or not. Which, in the end, Uriah Chiti, because of the setup that David made, didn't come back from the Milchama. And then retroactively, it would have made that she was divorced prior to that time, and that would have made it into a Safek Eshedish. The Baal Yad Tosafot are bothered by this because the Gemara in Gitin, in discussing this issue, has a machloket as to what the status of a woman is. If her husband gives her a get, that only goes into effect from today until the point that I die, then it goes into effect. Again, he's trying to protect her from Yibum. What is the status of the woman in the interim stage? And over there, it's a machloket whether she's considered to be an Eshedish or whether she is only a Safek Eshedish. But in either case, it's a problematic engagement. There's a machloket whether she's an Eshedish d'oraita or only a Eshedish, let's call it midrabanan, that we worry about her engaging with someone else. But in either case, there's no permissibility with engaging with this woman. And for that reason, the Baal Yad Tosafot don't like this explanation, both here and in the Gemara and Shabbat. And therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam suggests the following. Mefaresh Rabbeinu Tam, de Milchemet Beit David, ayu migarshin legamrei. Below shum tanai. Without any conditions. Then when they went out to war, they gave them a full-fledged get. No unconditioned get. If I return, they gave them a get. El ayu sima devar bitzin a. But they used to do it privately, not in public. Because then they put their wives at risk, which is while the soldiers are out at war, people might try to grab their wives or entertain the possibility of marrying their wives because they are now single women. But now he's in a big problem. Why is it called Safek Eshedish now? It's not Eshedish at all. She's completely divorced. And that's why they called it Safek Eshedish, because it was done bitzinah. Wasn't done in public, was only done in private. So nobody knew about her. It wasn't obvious that they were divorced. So that's why they called it Safek Eshedish, using it as Bederach Melitza, not literally that they were Safek Eshedish, but it looked optically like it was an Eshedish. He says, Ulechol HaPerushim Kasheh, says all the explanations, whether it's Rashi's, whether Rabbeinu Tam's, it's difficult. Tafilo Baal Eshedish Vadai Tov Mi Malbin. He says, because it doesn't really matter. The way that David is expressing it, it says that it's better to engage in adultery than it is to be involved in Malbim Pnei Chaveru Barabim. Midikamar David, a Baal Eshedish, Mitato Bechenek. David's response to them is, whoever engages in adultery, this is the death penalty. That is a definitive Eshedish. It's not a Safek Eshedish. And V'yesh lo chelek l'olam haba. So he said the expression of Safek Eshedish is very difficult given the drasha. It's also difficult given the explanations, both of Rashi and the Baal Yad Tosafot. And therefore, you have to say here or suggest something along the lines of Safek Eshedish. You can either drop the word Safek and say a Baal Eshedish, or it's Safek Eshedish. It's just a way to couch this in a little better terms. But the truth is that he's saying that it's better to be engaged in adultery than to embarrass people in public, but emphasizing the Safek Eshedish, because that Avera is Yoter Chamura, because a person is less likely to do tshuva for such an Avera, as we noted from the Rabbeinu Yonah earlier. And now, the Gemara continues with similar type of Memra, which is Mar Zutra Batuvi Amar Rav. Amri La, and some say it's Amar Rav Chana or Rav Huna, Barbizna Amar Rabbi Shimon Chasida, Amri Lo, and then some say it's Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rishibun Bar Yochai, who were also authors of the original thing that got us into this, which is Gadol Onat Dvarim Onat Mamon, and that led us into this sugya. Noach Lo La Adam Sheapil Atzmo LeKibshan Eish V'Alya Bin Pnei Chaveiro Berabim. It's better for a person to throw themselves into a fire and not embarrass their friend in public. So here, this is the source for the fact that what the Rabbeinu Yonah said yesterday, we quoted from the Shari Tshuva, his Perish and Pirkei Avot, as well as the Balei Tosafot and the Gemara and Sota, that suggest that Malbin Pnei Chaveiro, that is compared to Ritzicha, to killing, is a literal comparison, which means that it's subject to the same rules of Yehareg V'al Yavor, that one has to give up their life rather than embarrass someone in public, which we're just saying now, better to throw oneself into the fire, onto the pyre, or be burnt at the stake, rather than embarrass someone in public. And so they take this not in an allegorical manner, which would have been the easiest way to read it, and the most likely way to read it. They take it very literally, and he calls it avak ritzicha, or a snifle ritzicha, and therefore he believes that you have an obligation to be yehareg ve'al yavor. Now, the difficulty with that is the language that's used here in the Gemara, the first of which is Noach lo da adam. It's better for a person. If they are right, the Rabbeinu Yonah and the Tosafot and Sota, it should say Chayav Adam. You're obligated because it's Yareg Val Yavor, rather than Noach lo da adam. That's number one. Number two is the possibility over here that there's a difference between the normal case of Yareg Val Yavor and this. In the case of Yareg Val Yavor, it involves where the person comes to you and says, either you kill or you be killed. And that option, you have to take up the passive option, which is you do not kill, but rather you allow yourself to be killed. You disengage from anything, you do no activity, and therefore it results in your death. Over here, it's saying, Shiapil Atzmo LeKibshan Eish, which is committing suicide. So here you're taking an active approach to this, which is to kill oneself rather than embarrass someone in public. And that is not necessarily Yehareg Val Yavor, which makes it a little more difficult. It also is difficult because of the logic associated with, how do we know that by Ritzicha Yehareg Val Yavor? The Gemara says, Svarahi. It's a logical argument. My chazit, the damak sumak tfei. How do you know that your blood is redder than your fellow man's blood? That's true. That's not the reason why you would have to give up your life here rather than embarrass someone in public. Because the logic that is dictated over there is not the same logic over here. Because here you're dealing with two different issues. You're not dealing with ritzicha and ritzicha. You're dealing with killing yourself or embarrassing someone else. Now, even if you equate it to ritzicha, the person is still alive afterwards. And so therefore, that logic also breaks down. For that reason, many believe that this is only allegorical and not literal in meaning. But you should know that there are girsaot that drop out the Noach lo, or girsaot that make it more palatable or plausible that it could be Yehareg Va'al Yavor. Minale, how do we know this is true? Mitamar. Dichtiv, he mutzeit, v'hi shalchal chamia, famous story with Tamar and Yehuda. She is being taken out to be burnt at the stake, and she sends to her father-in-law without identifying him to say that to wherever these belongings are, I am pregnant. And so Yehuda had to make a choice whether to identify himself or not. But she herself does not identify the perpetrator over here or the fact that it is Yehuda that did it. Interesting, he mutzeit is from the Lashon of Tzei, to go out. She is taken out. The Gemara here is clearly darshing mutzeit to mean to burn, which as Tosafot points out over here, he mutzeit below aleph, without an aleph in it. Kamal b'yetzeit ish b'tzion. From Eicha, which is that he kindled a fire in Tzion. Problem with that is that in our Sifrei Torah, it's written with an Aleph. The Gemara here seems to be indicating, if you see the Balei Tosafot in Ketubot, they quote it from their Beinu Hananel, and over there it seems the way that they're quoting it, that's actually what's written in the Pasuk. He would say that it's written Chaser without an Aleph. Our Sifrei Torah all have it with an Aleph in it. So the way that we'd have to read it, and you can see the way that's printed in our Gemara, Mutzeit is not literally that they're reading it mutzeit, not taken out, but fire, but that's again, a play on the word mutzeit, because she was being taken out to be put on the fire. That was what her punishment was. It was going to be sreifa. So not from the mutzeit, the fire aspect over here, or the kindling aspect, for the fact that she's been taken out to the death penalty, and she still does not reveal what Yehuda had done. Amar Rav Chanina, or it's Chanina Brei de Ravidi, Maidi Chtiv. What is meant in the Pasuk, Blo tonu ish et amito, that you may not oppress, afflict your friend, Am she'itcha b'torah u'b'mitzvot. Someone who is with you in Torah u'mitzvot, al toneu. Don't afflict him, don't oppress him. Now, what's interesting over here, the Marsha points this out, that there's actually a difference in the psukim between how it's expressed with regards to onat mamon versus how it's expressed by onat divarim. The pasuk says, lo tonu ish et achiv. The pasuk tells us that you may not cheat your brother. Then it also says, what we're quoting over here, lo tonu ish et amito. And the Gemara and yesterday's daf distinguished between the two of them and said that lo tonu ish et amito is referring to onat varim, because we already have a pasuk of chitim kru memkar lamitecha kuno miyad mitecha, where it says lo tonu ish et achiv. There, tonu ish et achiv is referring to onat mamon. So he points out that by onat mamon it says achiv, by onat varim it says amito. So what's the difference between amito and achiv? That's what drives the drush over here. Amito is am shi'itcha b'torah mitzvot. Only someone who's with you with Torah mitzvot. And that's what the Marsha points out. You're not allowed to embarrass people who keep Torah mitzvot, or at least try to keep Torah mitzvot. But if someone is a person who does not keep Torah mitzvot, then he over there suggests that you have a right to embarrass them because they're somebody who doesn't keep the Torah mitzvot, and you have to make sure that people don't follow in their ways or do not take a lead from this individual. Or maybe more importantly, this person is not worried about their own embarrassment because they're willing to sin and do these things without any inhibition. And so therefore, embarrassing them about the fact that they're doing this, they don't care about themselves, so why should you care? I think even without the drush of the Marsha of saying that you are obligated in that case to embarrass them, but the circle of people who are affected by your lo tenushi tamito is a smaller circle. It's a circle of those that keep Torah mitzvot. Whereas achiv comes to exclude an achri, to say that onat mamon only has application to Jews, but it does not have application to non-Jews. And therefore, there's a difference between onat devarim, which has that smaller circle of amito, versus onat mamon, which has a bigger circle. We're not allowed to cheat anyone, but it comes to the exclusion of a nachri. Amarav, lo'olam yei adam zehir ba'onat ishto. Person should be careful with onat ishto. Over here is obviously dealing with onat devarim, which is causing pain to his wife. Shemitoch shedimata mitzuya onata krova. Because she cries easily, or her tears are quick to come, then onata krova means that the repercussions of the affliction are quick to come. And we're going to see in a second, the Gemara is going to discuss this, but the fact that the sharei dim'a, the gates of crying or of tears, are never closed, and therefore Kodesh Baruch Hu is always quick to respond to those that cry. The psukim in the Torah and Mishpatim also say that, that when the person calls out to me, I will respond to them. Meaning when the Ani calls me, I'm going to come and take retribution on you for what you did. So the same thing over here, that if the woman is easy to cry or break down over the onat devarim, then the punishment will also be swift because Hashem will respond to that affliction and to protect the individual. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Meyom shenechrab beit hamikdash, ninalu sharei tefillah. And that is the segue into this next sugya, which is, from the time that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, the gates of tefillah have been sealed or closed. Shenemar, because the pasuk says, Gam ki ezak, even when I cry out, va'ashaveya, and I plead before you, Hashem, satam tefilati, you have sealed or closed out my tefillah. You are rejecting my prayer. The Marsha over here says that the word satam is used also in Chumash by Bil'am. Over there, again, it's without nikudot, but there it's shtum ha'ayin. And we've seen in the Gemara, Rashi brings down both interpretations, that shtum ha'ayin can either mean a closed eye, or shtum ha'ayin can be an open eye socket. And so he suggests over here, shatam instead of satam means open tefilati. Because what the person is saying is, gam ki ezak v'shaveya, even when I cry out and plead, shatam tefilati, to open up my prayer, meaning that the prayer is to open up the gates. That's what you have to pray for. Why do you pray to open up the gates? Because the gates are locked. And that's how the Marsha learns it from the Pasuk, not Satam, but rather Shatam, which means to open the gates through my tefillah, indicating that the gates are sealed. Even though the gates of tefillah are locked, when it comes to the gates of tears, they are not closed, because in Amar, the Pasuk says, Shim'at tefillati Hashem, you should hear my prayer, v'shavati hazina, and pay heed to my pleading, el dimati al techerash, to my tears, do not be silent. And as the Balei HaTosafot explain over here, ein omer shama el bichi, o ra'a dimati, doesn't say listen to my cry, or see my tears, el al techerash, do not be silent in the face of my tears. Klomar, batuach ani, shelo techerash, I know that you will not be silent, shesharei dmarot nonin alu, because the gates of tears have not been closed, meaning that in this pasuk, there's an underlying assumption where that which he's doing here will be heard. So now he wants the what's being heard to be responded to. But El Demeti El Techerash presumes that the Dima'ot will reach Hashem. And it's saying, don't be silent to those tears, but he knows that the tears are reaching Hashem because the gates must be open. And for that reason, we actually say in the Slichot, that we say at Ni'ilah, it also mentions in the Slichot during the Aseret Me'etshuva, we mention it as well, but we mean the Slichot in Ni'ilah on Yom HaKippurim, Tamachti Yedeidotai B'Shlosh Esrei Tevot, I have put my stand, or I put my stick in the ground with the 13 attributes, U'Bisharei Dema'ot, and the gates of tears, Kilo Nishlavot, because they never are sealed. Lachain shafachti siach pnei bochein libot. Therefore, Hashem, I've poured out my heart before you. Batuach ani be'ele. I am certain in these items, uschut shloshet avot, and the merits of our forefathers. But we say exactly that, that the sharei dma'ot lo nishlavot, that the gates of tears are never sealed. And we also say at the end there, yihi ratzon milfanecha, we beseech Hashem, shomea kol b'chiyot, the one who hears all cries, Shitasim dimotenu benotcha liyot, to place our tears into the flask to be kept, v'tatzilenu mikol gzerot achzariyot, and save us from any terrible decrees, ki l'chal vadcha en enu tluyot, because we look up to you. In both cases, we're invoking tears and crying because of what's said here in the Gemara, that sharei dema'ot are never closed. And so now the Gemara continues, v'amarav, kol ha'olech batzat ishto, now we're dealing with his wife, and saying one should not have onat dvarim with his wife because it will be dangerous for him. It also says that a person who goes with the advice of his wife, nofel b'geinom, he falls into geinom. Shinamar, because the pasuk says by Achav, lo aklo ayake Achav, there was no one like Achav, bara, because he listened to atzat Izebel ishto. He listened to the advice of his wife Izebel. I mean that Izebel added on, Achav followed in the ways of Yeravam, and he worshipped Avodah Zarah and so on and so forth, what all the kings did until then. Here, Achav had taken it up a notch, because Izebel brought in all of this foreign Avodah Zarah, all these things that she added that made it worse, in terms of the Nevi'ei Abal, the killing out of the Nevi'im, and the incident that happened with Nevot HaKarmeli, so many things that Izebel was involved with, where she made it so much worse. So the fact that he followed the advice of his wife Izebel made him so much worse. So isn't there a common expression, a colloquial expression? If your wife is a midget, gachin v'tilchoshla, you should bend over. And over here, the way that the Lashon says, it sounds like to whisper to her, but the Rashi says is you should listen to her. She has something to say, and she's a midget, bend over and listen to what she has to say. That means that one should take the advice of his wife, or it sounds like you should listen to the advice of your wife. But it says, Lokasha, that's not a problem. Hi, b'mili d'alma, hala mili d'beita. The first distinction is made between worldly matters versus house matters, meaning that when it comes to the house, she's the queen of the house, and she dictates what happens inside of the house, and you should listen to her with regards to matters of the house. When it comes to more general items, there you don't have to or shouldn't take her advice. The other one is lishnachrina, have mile de shmaya, have mile de alma. The difference is whether it has to do with ruchaniyut, spiritual matters, or mile de alma, or has to do with mundane matters. The assumption being here that you listen to her with regards to mundane matters, and not necessarily with mile de shmaya when it comes to ruchaniyut matters, although you could easily read the Gemara just the other way around, which is that halamile de shmaya, in areas of ruchaniyut, where the woman has bina yetera and has more understanding or insight, that maybe there you should listen to the woman because she can guide the individual, like we see here, by Izebel, where she misled or took Achav into a path that had been much worse than others. And we know we have the famous stories with regards to how the woman who married the tax collector used to wrap the tax receipts on his arm, and the woman who married the Talmud Chacham used to wrap his tefillin on his arm. I mean, that the woman is very much a part and parcel of what happens in terms of the spiritual building of the house. And therefore, b'milei d'shmaya, like we see by Sarah, that kol asher tomar la'acha Sarah tishma b'kola, b'milei d'shmaya. Whereas milei d'alma, when it comes to worldly matters, she's not so involved in that, in the business and all the transactions. There you should not listen to her. So, Amar Rav Chisda, kol asherim n'alim chutz misharei ona'a. That all gates are sealed except the gates of Ona'ah. Now, this seems to be, in many senses, an equivalence, and I think the Marsha points this out, between that which we said before, that the gates of tears are never closed, so too the gates of Ona'ah are not closed. Ona'ah Dvarim means people who are afflicted by others, through words, who are embarrassed by others, because what do? They cry. And since they cry, the Sharei Ona'ah are never closed. Shenemar. It's an interesting pasuk that the Gemara brings from Amos. It says, "Hinei Hashem nitzav achumat anach." Hashem is standing on a wall that was plumbed, ubiado anach, and his hand is a plumb line. A plumb line is a way to determine if something is straight. And over there, the psukim go on to say that Hashem says that I'm tired of all of this. I'm going to destroy Bnei Yisrael because of all that they have done. But here, the Gemara seemingly is playing on the word anach, which is that also has some meaning or some connection to Ona'ah, whether that's just in a association manner, or whether that has to do with the plumb line. A plumb line is made to be straight, or a line that is straight. Ona'ah is what means to deviate from what is the market price, and to cheat someone, or anat dvarim, again, which is a play on that, is also someone who doesn't act civilly with others, but causes them pain and suffering by embarrassing them and denigrating them. So that's why the anach over here is this idea or the concept of ona'ah surrounding the anach, because the plumb line swings or moves back and forth until it finds the straight line, which is this idea of ona'ah, which is moving away from that which is the straight line. Rabbi Lazar, akol nifra bidei shaliach. All things are collected or paid back by a messenger, chutz me'ona'ah, with the exception of ona'ah, shenemar, ubiyado anach. Hashem is holding it in his hand. Hashem will respond to the ona'ah personally. And again, that's connected to what we said before, that the sharei ona'ah are not closed, because when it's Hashem, things happen immediately. Hashem's never on vacation. Hashem's never not listening. So therefore, the response is immediate. When you deal with the shliach, could be busy with something else. He could not be on call today. You could end up that the punishment takes time or there is more of a gap. But when it's Hashem, then it's immediate, the punishment. Amar Oibo, Gimel Eina Parkud Ninal Bifnehem. There are three people to which the pagod. Pagod is usually a separation, a veil of sorts. It was used in the Mikdash to separate between the Kodesh HaKodeshim and the Kodesh. They had a curtain there, which would also be the equivalent of a pagod. It was used also by the kings in Persia. Pargod was what separated the king's throne area from outside. But it's a veil or some sort of separation from where the king sits. The Gemara uses it many times to talk about Hashem's inner circle. The pargod is what separates between the outside and Hashem's inner circle. So it says over here that the pargod, that veil or that curtain, is not separated for three people. Here it's in a negative sense, which is ona'ah, v'gezel, v'avodah zarah. For these three items, the pargod is wide open. So here again, it's in a negative sense, meaning that these reach directly to Hashem, and Hashem responds in kind, which is ona'ah dichtiv ubiyado anach. That within Hashem's hand is anach, and that He responds directly and personally to the ona'ah or the violations of ona'ah. Gezel dichtiv chamas vishod ishama ba al panai tamid. So again, here this idea that it's always in front of me, So chamash v'shod, the plundering and the stealing and the theft, I am aware of it, I hear it, and it's in front of me all the time. Avodah zarah dichtiv ama machesim oti al panai tamid. They are angering me with their avodah zarah, but it's in front of me all the time. So all of these have to do with being in front of Hashem's face means it's directly there. There's no separation. This goes directly to Hashem, and Hashem responds again directly. Am Rav Yehuda, lo'olam yehei adam zahir bitvua betoch beito. A person should always ensure that there's food in the house. Shem miriva mitzuya betoch beito shel adam al iskei tvua. Because when there's a lack of food, there's a breakdown in the shalom bayit that exists. Shenemar, because the pasuk says, hasam gvuleich shalom, Hashem who puts up the boundaries of peace, chelev chitim yasbiech, that the fat of the chitim yasbiech will satisfy you. So the Gemara sees a connection between the two parts of the pasuk, which is shalom, peace, is associated with yasbiech, being satisfied or having that which to eat. And so therefore, Amar Papa, Ainu Damrei Inche, that is the common expression that people say, kimashlim sare mikado. When the barley has finished from the barrel or the flask, nakish va'ati tigra bebeita. So you can read this in one of two ways. Nakish means to come knocking. So you could say nakish va'ati tigra bebeita, then quarrel and strife come knocking in the house. Because the barrel is empty means that there's no longer any food left. And point out that we're talking about se'ora here, we're talking about barley. Barley is not the primary food item. Chita is the primary food item for people. Se'ora was usually used as animal feed. So it's already they're down to the se'ora and the se'ora's run out. So when the food runs out, then strife and quarrel will be coming. That's one way to read it. Or nakish could be modifying the kad. When the kad makes a lot of noise because there's very little in it, then strife comes to the house because there's no food that's involved. But hunger and a lack of food lead to a breakdown of the household. V'amrav chinina bar papa, lo'olam yei adam zeir b'tvua, b'toch b'to. Person should make sure to always have food in the house. Shanoni kru'u Yisrael dalim, elal yiskei tvua. Because B'nai Yisrael are not known to be poor, or classified as poor, or impoverished, because of the tvua, shenemar. Because the pasuk says in Shoftim, this is immediately after Shirat Devorah, it is the introduction to the next section which begins the rule of Gid'on. And in there it describes the plight of Bnei Yisrael, which is Vayayim Zara Yisrael, when the Jews planted, the chule is that Amalek and Midian used to plunder the fields. They used to come and take everything that the Jews planted. They used to come and take for themselves. Uchti Vayachanu Alehem. And then it says that they encamped there. The psukim actually continue. It's very interesting that the Gemara doesn't quote it because it somewhat undermines the drasha, which is that it says there that they stole all that they had planted, but then it says that they let their animals graze and they brought all of their possessions into the valleys and basically left the place desolate. So there's much more going on here. They're stealing their animals. They are taking all their possessions. It's not just the food that they're taking. And then the pasuk says, "Uchtei vayidal Yisrael ma'od mipnei Midyan." The Bnei Yisrael were very impoverished before Midyan. So the Gemara connects it back to the original pasuk, which is "Vayayin zara Yisrael." When they planted, so when they were planting and all the food was taken, then they're called vayidal Yisrael. Even though, again, in the interim, I told you there are psukim that discuss other things. They were plundering everything. They were taking everything in the valleys, and the Jews were afraid. They were hiding in the caves. They were up on the mountains because there was no safety for them down below. And then it leads to this idea that Hashem sends the Navi and tells Bnei Yisrael why they're being afflicted, because of the fact that they don't remember the God that took them out of Mitzrayim and they're worshiping Avodah Zarah. And that segues into Gidon, meeting the Malach, who he asks, where is that God that took us out of Mitzrayim? All the stories we heard from our forefathers, and yet here we're being devastated by these nations, and that leads to Gidon rising to become the next Shofet. But here you see the connection between Vayidal, and the way that they're expressing is it goes back to the beginning or the opening of this section, which is Vayayim Zara Yisrael. So that's what you have to say here, is that the Gemara sees that as being the primary aspect of what is impoverishing Bnei Yisrael, is that all their food is being taken. V'amar Rabbi Chelbo, lo mihei adam zeir b'chvod ishto. Person should always be careful in the honor of his wife. Shein bracha mitzuya b'toch b'ito shel adam, ela b'shvil ishto. Because blessing is only found in the house because of one's wife. Shenemar, very interesting pasuk that the Gemara quotes over here, because almost this pasuk in its pashtut, and you read it in the psukim, is exactly the opposite of the way the Gemara is using it here, which is ula Avram heitiv bavura, that Avram benefited because of Sarah. So the Gemara is saying it's because of Sarah he was enriched. But as the Ramban points out over there, and if you look at Rashi, the way he interprets it, ula Avram heitiv bavura, Avram said, Sarah, I want you to say you're my sister, in order that they don't kill me, plus that they're going to give us lots of gifts and pay us lots of money, that they're going to be tov to us because of that. And so Avram sees in this whole incident that happens when they go down to Mitzrayim, that when they take Sarah, he's going to be enriched by the fact that they take Sarah. And so Sarah was taken to the Paro's palace, and whatever happened in Paro's palace, this is not obviously kvod ishto, this is something where she is afflicted, taken away. It's not the most pleasant of scenes. Ramban even points out that Avram might have sinned over here in what he did with Sarah and allowing her to be taken to Beit Paro. And the Gemara quotes that as the pasuk, as the source for the fact that one is enriched by their wife, although we do know that Avram treated Sarah with tremendous kavod and respect. We see that both from the perspective of the drashot that we say with regards to when Avram pitched his tent, he always pitched his wife's tent first and took care of her needs first. We also know the fact that he listened to what Sarah said. He always heeded what she said, and Hashem tells him to heed what she said. So Avram is very responsive and very respectful of his wife. And so I think from a more general standpoint, rather than the exact pasuk that they quote, Avram's treatment of Sarah and taking care of his wife is what leads to Avram's enrichment in the sense that he benefits from that treatment of his wife. I mean, if you read the pasuk literally out of context, it just says that Avram was given tov, or was enriched, bavura, because of Sarah. And so they're reading it literally that way, that Sarah was the cause for his enrichment, which is true. That Sarah is the cause for his enrichment, not necessarily the way that you would have thought, but that is the way the pasuk's being read. V'hainu damarlu Rova l'bnei Bechuza. And that's what Rova says to b'nei Bechuza. Rova was the mardatra there in Bechuza. Bechuza is a very wealthy city. Okiru l'nishaychu. You should make sure to honor your wives. Ke'echad t'datru. So that you should become wealthy, meaning that he gives them incentive for treating their wives properly, because there's a benefit to treating your wife properly that will enrich you. Right now we move into one of the most famous Gemarot in Shas. It's a Gemara about Tanur Shalachnai, the argument between Rabbi Lezer and the Chachamim about Tanur Shalachnai. It's not autumn. We have a Mishnah in Kelim that says, Chatchu Chuliot, if you cut it into sections, Natan Chol ben Chulia l'Chuliyan, and you put sand between each section, Rabbi Lezer mitaher, Rabbi Lezer ben Hurkanus says it is tahor, for Chachamim mitamim. On the other hand, the Chachamim say it's tamei. That is found in a perek that deals with kli cheres and ovens that are kli cheres. We know that the din of kli cheres is that it can become tamei min haTorah, as opposed to kli glalim or kli adama. When you do things that are made out of dung or out of dirt of the ground, they are not mikabel tuma. Stone is not mikabel tuma. Cheres is mikabel tuma, meaning that when you take the clay and you mold it into a clay, then that can be mikabel tuma. Once it's mikabel tuma, there's no way to remove the tuma, ella lishaver. You have to break it or leitotz. You have to undermine it, uproot it. It has to be broken in order to remove the tuma. So Rashi claims over here, the Rishonim line up in different ways here. Rashi claims that both things are true here, that the machloket here is both for a tanur that became tamei. How are you mitaheret? So Rabbi Lezer says if you cut it up in this way and put the sand between it, that removes the tumah. The Chachamim say that does not remove the tumah. In addition, if you take this oven and use it in the future, Rabbi Lezer says that it remains tahor, it cannot become tamei, whereas the Chachamim say it can become tamei. The reason is that the way that their ovens were made, they were mostly like cone-shaped, where widened at the bottom, narrow towards the top, had a hole in the top, and that's where you put the pots to cook. So you heat it up on the inside. Now what they did here, they used to put around the kli cheres, there were sections that were stacked on each other, and then they used to put what's called a tefillah. They used to put some sort of, call it cement or plaster around it, and they used to bake it in that way to solidify, both insulate and solidify the oven. Over there, the Mishnayot speak about removing the tefillah, slicing the oven crosswise, meaning on a horizontal way, in order to destroy the oven, you slice it that way. So this Tanur Shachnai was sliced on a horizontal basis into sections that are less than 4 tefachim each. Then Rashi claims it makes it tahor, according to Rabbi Lezer. And also in the future it will be also tahor. Tosafot points out That's only in the future. It's Tahor because you put sand between the sections. Because you put sand between the sections, it makes it, it doesn't seal properly again. Even if you to put tefillah on it, that tefillah will never seal properly because of the sand that is between the sections. It does what it says. For that reason, Moder Rabbi Lezer, the Kli Choshevu, if you left out the sand and then you sealed it, that would be a Kli Choshev, and that would accept Tumah in the future because then the sections would stick together properly and it wouldn't be a problem of a Kli that is broken or not a Kli Cheres that is sealed. And so Tosfot says, if you take away the sand, that's not the case. So the Rashi says that the argument here is about both issues. The other Rishonim is saying that the argument's about whether breaking the oven in that way is mitayaret, or others that say it's only talking about a Kli that's made this way, is it mikabel tumah, because of the way or the nature by which it's made. And the Mishnayot over there also speak about when you put on the plaster, if you put dirt or packing between the plaster and the Kli Cheres, that Kli is also not tamei, because again, it doesn't seal properly. And so this is the next Mishnah after that, so it makes sense that we're speaking about something that, by putting the sand in there, makes it that doesn't seal properly. For that reason, you have a machlokah here between Rabbi Elazar and the Chachamim as to the status of such an oven. The way that Rashi claims is, the Chachamim say all ovens are made this way with the plaster put on top of sections. And so this is no different than those ovens, even though there's sand in between. Rabbi Elazar says that putting the sand in between, or putting it together in this way, already makes it that it's not a full-fledged Kli, and therefore it is Tahor. V'zehu Tanur Shel Achnai. And this is what is otherwise known as the Tanur Shel Achnai, that's the Mishnah says. Rashi over here says Achnai is the meaning Nachash, means a snake. And as Rashi says over here, that it wraps itself around, a snake many times wraps itself around, and then puts its tail into its mouth to lock the situation in place, which is that they surrounded him, or the arguments were about surrounding them with the machloket that was here, bringing proofs against his position. Could read it that way allegorically. You could also read about the fact that they sealed the oven around with the tefillah afterwards. Tosfot over here brings the alternate girsa, it says, V'yesh garas chachnai, v'chein b'yushalmi, b'chachan zenachash, v'shema bala tanur she'oseh shmokein. Tosfot brings the possibility that chachan is a nachash, but then brings the alternative, which is this Achnai or Hachnai was the name of the individual who made ovens like this. That he was a supplier, and he used to make his ovens this way, and that's why it's known as Tanur Shel Achnai, named after the proprietor that made these ovens or produced these types of ovens. So my Achnai, what's going on over here? I'm a Rav Yudah Mishmol, Shikifu Dvarim Kachnazu B'tamu, that they surrounded him like a snake with all these proofs, in order to be mitamei, the oven, and that's where I talked about the allegory that's made with the snake versus the achnai in the Yushalmi, which again could be achnai, could be the name of the individual who created it. Tana ba'oto yom eshiv Rabbi Eliezer kol tshuvot shebo'olam ve'lo kiblu emenu. On that day, Rabbi Eliezer brought all proofs, meaning that he had strong basis for his position, and he demonstrated that to the chachamim. Abraham, im alacha kemoti. He says, if I am right over here, and the alacha is like me, Charuv ze yochiach. This carob tree will prove it. Ne'akar charuv mimkomo me'ama. The carob tree moved 100 amot. Ve'amri lo arba me'ot ama. 400 amot. Again, both numbers of exaggeration, but the idea that the carob tree responded to what Rabbi Lezer said. Amri lo ein mivin me'ya min acharuv. Says you don't bring a proof from a carob tree. Chazav amar lehem im alocha kmoti amata mayim yochichu. Then the water channel here will prove it. The water started to flow in the opposite direction in order to prove that Rabbi Eliezer was correct. The Marsha over here goes through the allegory in the Charuv and the Mayim as to why they picked these items and what he was trying to show through these items. But I just noticed that in the story with Rabbi Shimba Yochai and his son in the Gemara in Shabbat, on Daf Lamed Gimel, over there the Gemara discusses that when Rabbi Shimba Yochai goes and hides in the cave, there are two things that are there that are provided for him. It's a charuf and a madamayim, there's mayim. So these are the two items that are associated with Limud HaTorah. I think there might be a connection over here as well, and that I think probably has to do with why he picked the carob tree and the mayim, which are considered to be the basics or basic sustenance of life, as well as what a person who's learning can survive on these. These are the basic things, and Rabbi Lezer is making that point. The basic sustenance or essentials of life are saying that I'm right over here. Once again, they said, you don't bring proof from a water channel. See, now he comes, doesn't use those basic essentials, now he brings down to the Kodei Beit HaMidrash. Hatu Kodei Beit HaMidrash Lipol. The walls of the Beit HaMidrash start to collapse. Garbahem Rabbi Yoshua. Yeshua hollers at them. Amar lahem, Im Tamidei Chachamim Etzchem Zeh Zeh Balacha, Adem Ativchem. Says, okay, if there's an argument between Tamidei Chachamim, you, the walls of the Beit HaMidrash, why are you getting involved? This isn't your issue. Why are you interfering in an argument between Tamidei Chachamim? Lo naflu mikvedo shel Rabbi Yoshua. The walls did not fall down because out of kavod for Rabbi Yoshua, they didn't fall in completely. Velo zakfu, but they also didn't upright themselves. Menei kvodo shel Rabbi Eliezer. Out of the kavod of Rabbi Eliezer, that's what we saw in the Gemara before, that there was another incident where the Kodei Beit HaMidrash had fallen part way, and the Amoraim there were arguing as to whether it was because of their position or their position that the walls came in. Out of whose respect did the pillar collapse or did the beam break in the Beit HaMidrash? But similar, playing on this story, the idea that Kodei Beit HaMidrash are responding to the Tanaim that are in the Beit HaMidrash. V'adayin matin v'omdim. And the Gemara says, you can go see those Kodei Beit HaMidrash, they're still on an angle. Chazar v'amar lehem, so now he brings the final proof. He brought proofs from the basic sustenance of life. He brought it from the Beit HaMidrash, from the place that houses the Torah. And they don't listen to him, so he finally says, I'm going to get God to intervene here. Let them prove it from the Shamayim. Not that until now it wasn't from the Shamayim, but meaning really God should speak about it. Yet stop batko, a heavenly voice comes out. What are you getting on top of Rabbi Eliezer for? The locha is like him everywhere. I mean here, mina Shamayim, they're paskin that Rabbi Eliezer is correct over here. Amad Rabbi Yoshua al-Raglav Amar. Again, Rabbi Yoshua gets up and declares, Lo b'shamayim hi. It's a very famous statement that the Torah is not up in the Shamayim. Rather, it's determined by man. Once God gave the Torah to man, it's no longer the purview of that which is going on in the Shamayim. So some explain that that is the argument that goes on between Moshe Rabbeinu and the Malachim. When Hashem is giving the Torah, that Moshe Rabbeinu says to the Malachim that the Torah is not relevant for you. It has nothing to do with you. Torah is given to man because it's relevant to man. And therefore, when it's in the hands of man, that's where it was determined. And you can't interfere or change the course of halacha because of what you see in Shamayim. So Gemara says, Ma lo b'shamayim hi. What does that mean that it's not min Shamayim? Am Rabbi Yirmiyah, Shuvar nitnat Torah mi Har Sinai. Torah was already given in Har Sinai to Bnei Adam. Enu ananu meshkichim bevat kol. Therefore, we do not pay heed to heavenly voices. Shvar katafta b'har Sinai b'Torah, because you already told us from Har Sinai in the Torah, acharei rabim lahatot. It follows the psak of the majority. The majority is koveya, what the halacha is, and therefore those from Min HaShamayim cannot interfere. I'm going to read the next Gemara and then come back and explain this. Ashkechei Rabbi Natan Eliyahu. Rabbi Natan bumped into Eliyahu, amalei mayavir akosh brochu b'ayishata. What was Hashem doing at that time when this is all going on down below? What is Hashem doing? Amalei kachayich, and he is smiling or laughing. Vamar nitzkuni banai, nitzkuni banai. My children have been victors over me. They have succeeded in beating me. So that's a very interesting statement. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and needs some sort of interpretation or explanation. And the explanation, which I think makes the most sense, is that what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying is that the integrity of the Torah was being preserved by the Chachamim over here. Which is that we have a principle that once the Torah was given from Sinai, Ein Navi Rashai, there's no Navi that is allowed to come and change or be Mechadesh anything in the Torah. That's true of a Navi, that's true of anything. And what Hashem is so excited about over here is the fact that these individuals were so makpid on the integrity of the Torah that they would not allow a bat kol to come in and interfere with that which is written in the Torah, which is acharei rabim latot. That the locha always follows the majority, and therefore a bat kol cannot interfere or change the course of a locha. And that's what it means here, nitzkuni banai, which is that Hashem is excited about the fact that they maintained the integrity of the Torah and didn't allow the bat kol to interfere with that which is given. More along the lines of what Hashem wants, that once the Torah was given at Har Sinai, that it remains intact, So that's an easier way to explain it, rather than suggesting, oh, once it's given from heaven down to Adam, then it becomes the purview of Adam, whether to the right or the wrong, mistakes or no mistakes, it becomes the halacha has been nikva yedei Adam, because that's the nature of Torah Shebaal Peh. Once you give it to Adam and you give it to people to pass down, then it's open to interpretation, it's open to change in the sense of how do we apply those halachot that were given, and that's in the purview of Adam and not in the purview of Shemayim. So that obviously empowers us much more and says that God has nothing to do with it. The explanation that I gave in some ways says that it really is about the integrity of Torah, and therefore that's why Hashem is excited, not because it's in our hands and we can do whatever we want with it, but rather the fact that we only follow the mechanism that the Torah gave us shows us how important or how much we are keeping the integrity of the Torah intact. So Tosafot asks your question, which is, wasn't there a bat kol in Erevin that says halacha is like Beit Hillel, not Beit Shammai? And the Gemara over there suggests that according to the one who says we don't listen to a bat kol, what do? So the Gemara there, who is the person who doesn't listen to a bat kol? The Gemara says Rabbi Yeshua. But we don't find Rabbi Yeshua anywhere else besides here, where Rabbi Yeshua gets up and says, we don't listen to a bat kol. So the Baya Tosafot would say, well, if that's the case, how come the Gemara in general seems to accept a bat kol over there? The Tosafot says that he separates between the case. Over here, the Rabbim, the majority, were against Rabbi Eliezer. And the bat kol was coming to support the position of Rabbi Eliezer. Whereas in the case of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel was the majority over Beit Shammai. The only safek they had was that Beit Shammai were harifei. They were much brighter, smarter. They had a sharper side to them. And therefore, they thought maybe, even though they're the minority, the halacha should be like them. The bat kol comes along to tell them, follow the majority. So there, the bat kol was upholding or reinforcing that which would have been the halacha anyway. And that's how the Baal Tosafot distinguished between the bat kol that's found by Beit Hillel versus the bat kol that is found over here. So Gemara says, and this is the sad part to the story, Amru oto ayom, Hiviu kol tarot shitiyeh Rabbi Eliezer v'sarfum beish v'nimnu alav birichu. On that day, they brought all tarot that Rabbi Eliezer had, paskin that they were tahor, and they burnt them as if they were tamei, and then they gathered together, and they put them into cherim. So Rashi over here says, ubirchu, that they put them into nidoy, whereas there are others that suggest it wasn't nidoy, but cherim, or there are others that even suggest that it's something even more severe here with the birchu. The problem being, and the reason they did this, is because Rabbi Eliezer was insistent on his opinion, even in the face of the majority. And we're going to see in a second that challenged or could upset, again, the integrity of halacha if they allowed Rabbi Eliezer to continue because he refused to give in to the majority. Even though the majority was against him, but he felt so strongly about his position, and that's what the bat kol is saying, that Rabbi Eliezer is really right. I mean, that he really believed in his heart of hearts that he was right. But we have a principle of zakin mamre, which is that once the majority is ruled, the individual has to submit to the majority, otherwise you challenge the integrity of the system. And that means that it's going to be a every man for himself or a vigilantism in the system. It won't work. The system of halacha must follow the majority, and one has to subject themselves to the majority. This might also have to do with the fact that Rabbi Eliezer is called Shamuti. In different places, the Gemara, there are different interpretations of what that means. Does Shamuti mean he was from Beit Shammai? Or Shamuti doesn't mean that he was put into Shamta, that he was put into excommunication. But that also has impact, which is that Rabbi Eliezer, even though he was from the school of Beit Hillel, he was drawn in or did have some opinions that were like Beit Shammai. And so that also causes a problem, which is that at that time period, they were trying to establish the halacha like Beit Hillel, and to make it that the Torah was one Torah, and that wasn't this division of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Rabbi Eliezer, who sustained or stuck with some of those positions of Beit Shammai, was also a threat to the ability of the Chachamim to establish clearly that the halacha was like Beit Hillel in this subsequent generation, which was then trying to make it clear there would only be one halacha, and the halacha would follow that of Beit Hillel. So Rabbi Yoshua is the champion of Beit Hillel, is from the school of Beit Hillel, but a champion of Beit Hillel, and therefore Rabbi Eliezer is problematic from both of these perspectives, but given his sharpness, given his position, we're going to see in a second, as one of the leading Talmidei Chachamim, it made it very problematic that he was engaged in this machloket and persisted in this machloket, and that's why they put him into nidui. Amru, mi elech viodio, who's going to go and tell him that they put him into shamta? Amru lem Rabbi Akiva, ani elech. He says, I'll go, Shemi Aleich Adam Sheinu Agun, because maybe someone who's inappropriate will go, Yodio, Nimtza Machrivet Olam Kulo, and he'll end up destroying the whole world. Meaning that if Rabbi Elazar gets upset here, there's not going to be a good outcome. So Rabbi Akiva, who in many places, actually we know that says, Ni Chamtanu Akiva Ni Chamtanu, that's the famous Gemara Dena Makot. Rabbi Akiva in many instances is a person who knows how to speak to people, knows how to reach the people and give nechama to the people. He also happens to be a Talmid of Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus is Rabbi Akiva's Rebbe. So he's going to his Rebbe, so he felt it was appropriate for him to go and tell him the news. Ma'asa Rabbi Akiva, and again, Rabbi Akiva shows tremendous insight here. Bavash shchorim nitatef shchorim. He dresses in black and wraps himself in black. Yeshav lifana birichuk arba amot. He sits before his Rebbe, Rabbi Eliezer, but he leaves a distance of four amot between them. Amalo Rabbi Eliezer, Akiva, Mayom, Miyomayim. Rabbi Eliezer right away knows there's something different. How is today different than any other day? Because he's wearing black, he's sitting it further away from him, he knows that there's something wrong, there's something has happened. Amalo Rabbi, Kimidumeli, Shechavirim, Bidilim, Mimcha. Says, I think that your Chavirim are separating from you. So instead of saying that they have separated you from them, he said it again in a way that made it easier, more palatable to Rabbi Eliezer. He says that your friends are separating from you. Again, another insightful way to deal with this, which was to put the blame or the separation on the other Chachamim, not on him. And Rabbi Eliezer, obviously being very bright and sharp, understands right away, Afu Karabi Gadaf, he rents his clothing, V'chalatz min alav, takes off his shoes, V'nishmat v'yashav al gabe karka, slips off the chair and sits on the ground. Again, the dinim of nidui are associated with avelut. They're both found in Moed Katan. And the Gemara in Moed Katan tries to figure out which nidrim of avelut apply to nidui. And the Baalei Tosafot over here say, don't conclude anything from here. He says, Ein lo achiach mikan, don't prove from here, hadimi baile v'moed katan. The question that is raised in Moed Katan, now, someone who's put into nidoy needs to rend his clothing or take off his shoes. You can't prove anything from here because maybe Rabbi Eliezer was doing this of his own volition. In order to pain himself or to show the pain that he was undergoing, he did it as a response, an emotional response rather than a halachic response. That's one way you could read it. Or the possibility is you can't prove anything from here about nidui, because here it was different. It was a cherim. It was a much stronger type of nidui. And therefore, maybe you can't prove anything about nidui. For either of those reasons, you can't read into this as anything being normative. But we see Rabbi Lezer's response. Zaguin ab dima'ot. His eyes began to tear. La'aka olam shlish b'zeitim, shlish b'chitim, shlish b'se'orim. The world was afflicted and it ruined a third of the olives, a third of the wheat, a third of the barley. These are all basic crops that are found in Eretz Yisrael. These are the basis of the sustenance here. And therefore it says here that they were all hurt by Rabbi Lezer's crying. And some say even the dough in the hands of the woman spoiled. Tana, ach gadol haya ba'oto ayom. There was great other gear says af, but anger on that day. Anywhere that Rabbi Eliezer looked, burnt up. And again here, by the way, that parallel to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai also applies. That's the same thing when Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and Rabbi Elazar, his son, exit from the cave. Everywhere they looked was burnt up, similar to over here. And there is a direct shoshelet. Rabbi Eliezer and Hurkanos is the Rebbe of Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva is the Rebbe of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. So Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanos is the grand Rebbe of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. So again, the parallel of the Charuv, the Mayim, and the burning up, these are all things that we see by that same story by Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Vaf Rabbi Gamliel aya bab sfina. Rabbi Gamliel was traveling in a boat returning. Amad alav nachshol de tavo. All of a sudden a great storm or waves came upon the boat and they were going to sink the boat. Amar k'mendumeli shein zeh l'bishvil Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanos. Rabbi Gamliel right away recognizes that this is all because of the pain that was caused to Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanos. Amar galgav v'amar stands up and says and calls out to God, Ribono shel olam, galoy v'yadua lefenecha, shelo lichvodi asiti. I didn't do this for my own honor. Velo lichvod beit abba asiti. And I didn't do it for the honor of my father because he was the nasi and his father with the shoshalet of the Nisi'im. So he says, I didn't do this because of Rabbi Elazar's challenge to the Nisi'ut. Ela lichvodcha. I did it for your honor, God. Shlo yirbu machlokot b'Yisrael. So there should not be all of this argument or differences in halacha in Kal Yisrael. We needed to solidify and unify the halacha here, and that was the problem that we're trying to solve. We're not trying to hurt Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus. We're trying to protect the integrity of the halachic system, and therefore we're not doing it for ourselves, we're doing it for you. Noach zayam zapo. The water subsided, and it calmed down. So he was successful in saying that. What's interesting here about the story of Rabbi Gamliel is, first of all, Rabbi Yeshua is the one who responds to Rabbi Eliezer, not Rabbi Gamliel, which is a little surprising. If Rabbi Gamliel was present, why wasn't he the one responding? Number two is, it makes it sound like the fact that they put him to Nidui there, that Rabbi Gamliel wasn't present. He wasn't leading the proceedings. And he was out on the boat. So then Rabbi Gamliel says, oh, I know about this incident, and I think it's because of this incident, which implies that Rabbi Gamliel was there. So why is he out on a boat? He was taking a day trip. It's not clear how Rabbi Gamliel was involved in the incident, but also out on the boat. Ema Shalom debitu de Rabbi Eliezer. The wife of Rabbi Eliezer was Ema Shalom, achtei de Rabbi Gamliel havai. She was the sister of Rabban Gamliel. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is the brother-law of Rabban Gamliel, the Nasi. So not only are they quarreling in terms of being Talmidei Chachamim, their family, their brother-in-laws. From that moment forward, his wife, Ema Shalom, never let Rabbi Eliezer say Tachanun to fall on his head, because she knew that if he fell Tachanun, then that would be the end. First of all, this shows you the tremendous power of Tachanun. Everybody wants to skip Tachanun, but here you see how powerful Tachanun is, that his wife won't let him fall Tachanun, because she knows as soon as he is Nofela Apayim, that's going to result in her brother dying, which we're going to see in a second. So the Rabbeinu Bechai talks about this in Parshat Shlach Korach, about the idea of Nefilat Apayim being a tremendous way to connect to Hashem, and the tremendous power of Nefilat Apayim and Tachanun that we see over here. And that day was Rosh Chodesh. And she mixed up between whether it was a Malay and a Chaser. The way Rashi describes it over here, which is somewhat difficult, Rashi says that it was a case where she thought it was a Chaser. There was a 29-day month. And therefore today was Rosh Chodesh. So he wasn't going to be no fella paim. She didn't need to stop it. It turned out it was really a 30-day month. And therefore Rosh Chodesh was not the next day, but 2 days from now. And therefore, he was Nofel al-Apayim, and that's what caused the problem. The issue with that is, and what you're going to have to say to answer it, is that the fact that on the 30th day, when we have a month that is 30 days, we have 2 days of Rosh Chodesh, on the 30th and the 1st. We don't say Tachanun either day. So what you have to say, and the Marsha points this out, is that according to Rashi, when they were Mekadesh al-Piriyah, when they did a Chodesh Malay, they only kept 1 day of Rosh Chodesh, they didn't have 2 days of Rosh Chodesh. The Marsha says, if it was up to me, I would have said it was just the opposite. The case is the exact opposite of Rashi, and then it makes it easier. She thought it was a Malay. She thought it was a 30-day month. So today was Rosh Chodesh, and then the next day would be Rosh Chodesh. It turned out it was really a Chaser. And so therefore only today was Rosh Chodesh, the next day wasn't Rosh Chodesh. And then she didn't stop him the next day because she thought it was a Malay. Turned out to be a Chaser, and therefore he fell upon the next day. Others suggest that the story is that a poor person showed up at the door at that moment. Afika le'rifta, she went to take bread to the poor person. As soon as she came back, she saw that he was doing tachnun, that he had fallen on his face. Amra le, she says to him, kum, kadli lachi. Get up, you just killed my brother. She knew, without any news, without any information, if he fell tachnun, her brother, Rabbi Gamliel, would pass away. Because Rabbi Eliezer, in saying the tefillah of Tachanun and asking for Hashem to take care of his pain, that retribution would be taken out on her brother who was the Nasi. Arachi, almost immediately, Nafak Shipura Mibet Rabbi Gamliel, the shofarot, or the announcements, came out of the house of Rabbi Gamliel, Deshchiv, that he passed away, and she was right about her assessment. Amar La Amina Yadat said to her, how did you know? I have a mesora from my forefathers. Now, Avi Abba would be literally mean grandfather. So it could be that she's the sister of Rabbi Gamliel. So Rabbi Shimon was their father, and Rabbi Gamliel was their grandfather. So that might be, as Bali Tosfos, she's referring to her grandparents or the Shoshelet and the Siyim, that she has a mesora like this. Or Avi Abba could just mean more general. The Nisiyim descend from David HaMelech, and she's saying, I have a Mesorah from David HaMelech, from Tehilim. I have this Mesorah. Kol HaSharim Ninalim, Chutz Misharei Ona'ah. All gates are closed, with the exception of the gate of Ona'ah. This is how this story connects back to our Gemara, here in the final line, which is that he was afflicted. He was pained by what his chaverim had done, how they had spoken to him, how they had dealt with him. And therefore, when he fell for Tachanun, Hashem took retribution right away because of the Ona'ah, the pain. Tanu Rabbanan. Ha-me'anet et ager over b'shlosha lavim. Someone who afflicts the ger, a convert, a violation of three negative precepts. V'lo chatzo, and someone who puts pressure on him, over b'shtayim, violates two. What's the difference between when you afflict him, when you say things to cause him pain, that there are three lavim, because the pasuk says, v'ger lo toneh, v'chi agurit chager ba'aretzichem lo tonu oto, v'lo tonu ish et amito. So lo tonu ish et amito is a generic statement, but v'ger v'chlal amitohu. But a ger is subsumed under the category of amito. So therefore I have three psukim that tell you not allowed to be me'aneh the ger. But there are also three pisukim by oppressing him, by pressuring him. Lo tilchatzenu, v'ger lo tilchatz, v'lo tiyeh lo kenosheh. And you shouldn't be someone who pressures him to repay. But so there again, v'ger bichlalu. Nosheh just speaks about it in a more generic sense, and a ger is included. You're right. If you, in a verbal way, afflict the ger, then you are subject to these three lavim. If you oppress the ger here, it means you're pressuring him for repayment in order to get your money back, or you're commercially pressuring him, then you're also in violation of three lavim. So then there is no difference between me'aneh et ager and alochetz et ager. I think the point being here, the Gemara is noting how severe or how problematic this type of behavior is. And the focus on the ger is because, especially in their society, a ger, yatom v'almana, a ger not always being a convert, but a ger meant anybody who was a foreigner, an outsider. All those individuals were found at the bottom of the social ladder. They were the individuals who were most easily taken advantage of. They are the most easily proven who could be offended and affronted because nobody stands up for them. And therefore the Torah goes out of its way to protect the most vulnerable in society. And the ger being one of those individuals who is one of the most vulnerable in society. And the Torah goes and makes an emphasis on protecting those individuals. And the guarantor of that is God. And that's what it means over here, that Kol HaMe'aneh, Hashem directly gets involved, because when they cry out, Hashem says, I will respond. I am the protector of the ger, the Yatom HaAlmana. I'm the protector of the most feeble in society. Why did the Torah warn us about the ger in 36 places? Some say 46 places. I think Dushami also says 58. So Bali Tosafot point out, it depends on how you count it. When you say Ki Garim Aitem in Mitzrayim, is that counted amongst the psukim? Or is it only when it's talking about not doing something bad to the ger? So depending on which psukim you count, you'll get a higher or lower number as the number of times that it's mentioned. Mipnei Shesuro Ra. Because he has a bad lot in life. In that his situation is a very difficult situation. And if you do afflict him, then really bad things will happen to you. And you might cause the ger to reverse his decision to convert. Your mistreatment of the ger might lead to him going back to his old ways. So because of that, the Torah warns you to take care and pay heed to not afflict or to offend the ger. My dichtiv, the ger lo tonev lo tilchatzenu, ki gerim ha'itim beretz Mitzrayim. Why does it connect the fact between don't afflict the ger, don't pressure him, because you were gerim in Mitzrayim? Because, Rabbi Natan Omer, mum shebecha, al tomar lechavercha. When something is wrong with you, you shouldn't be poking fun at someone else. So the point being that you were once also gerim. So remember, you were once strangers. You were also someone who was an outsider. So just like you're an outsider, don't cause pain or difficulty for someone else who is an outsider. This is the colloquial expression. The zakif le zakifa b'diukte. B'diukte means in his family. So if there was someone who was hanged in this person's family, lo neima le dechavre zakif benita. Don't say to your friend, can you hang up that fish? I mean, that the word hang should not be mentioned in the context of the family because of the fact that it's a very sore point. It's a very difficult issue for the family. So anything that is even relatively close to mentioning about hanged, don't mention it because it's going to bring up these issues. And the same thing here. Ki gerim ha'itim be'eretz Mitzrayim. You were once a ger, so don't bring up issues of the ger because you don't want to speak about it, just like you were gerim. And you don't want to mention it, so too by the gerim here. Don't mention it because it's something that affects you as well. It's something that shouldn't be mentioned in the context of your situation. Okay, stop here by the Mishnah on the bottom of Nuntet Amud Bet.